September 1934, a 21-year-old newlywed, Olga Schultz Major, heads to Togatee Pass in Wyoming to hunt elk on her honeymoon with her new husband. He says he last saw her sitting on a boulder in the mountains when they stopped to rest. Then she simply vanished. Now, 90 years later, Olga is considered Wyoming's oldest known missing persons case. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Susan Rattan.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, have I mentioned lately how much I like the 1930s?
Only a billion times.
I know we have covered so many cases from then lately. And at this point, I mean, I was like apologizing for how much we were doing, but I'm not doing that anymore. Like, I promise. In 2025.
There's no need to apologize to me because, as we've said before, I have an easier time digesting the stories that are a little bit past than I do about the more present cases. These make me sad, but in a very different way than the cases where, like, everybody involved is still here, except for the woman.
Right. I mean, we will be doing some more current contemporary cases, but I just get so enraptured in these stories. And some of what happens is sort of my process is I'll be researching a case, right? And a lot of it is newspaper archives and stuff. And so I'll have some articles up and I will just like legit like read like every article on the page. And through that, like very often I'm like clipping other cases and other things to come back to. So that's part of what happens. So.
But some of the things that you are finding with your little light side stories that are actually newspaper articles are not things that would be published now.
No.
A lot of them are just like weird, quirky news that, like, I mean, what have you told me about in the past? Like some of these old ones. We've got dogs who were chloroformed.
I think they were, right?
Right. Yeah. What else have we had? We've had like, oh, the girl who got into like an actual fight with a deer.
Yeah, it was like a deer person showdown.
Like, would those things make it into the paper now? No. But are they interesting?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Do we want to hear more of those? Yeah. Yes. Do you have any of side stories today?
There are no side stories that I have for today. But this is also why I created my newsletter, Girl Hunt, so that some of the stuff that doesn't fit here.
So if you come across a story, but there's actually no connection.
Right.
Then like, you can...
Yeah, so, like, if it's not about a missing or unidentified woman, or sometimes if it is, but just, like, might not be as much information as we might need for a podcast.
Right.
Like Girl Hunt is my newsletter where you can find some of that extra bonus stuff.
Right, because those two stories I mentioned, I think they were directly related to...
To the case.
The case in one way or another. Like, yes. Maybe in a roundabout way.
Yeah, I mean, like, so, but... in this, I do kind of go off on a small side quest to talk about the development of an oil town, but for the most part I stay on track with this one. So we are going to 1934 for the story in what seems like the oldest missing person cold case on record in the state of Wyoming. And we're going to talk about the disappearance of 21-year-old Olga Schultz Major. And for clarity for people who are interested in researching later, that is spelled M-A-U-G-E-R. I'm glad someone created the pronunciation guide for that.
Because, like, yeah. Ew. Wait, so it's...
Major.
It's major. So, yeah, I would not have gotten major out of looking at this.
Yeah. Okay, so picture this, Vanessa. It's the fall of 1934, and we're at a dance hall in the small town of Midwest, Wyoming.
That sounds like an adorable way to start this Like, let's think about it. What do you think they were, like, wearing? What were they dancing to? Like, what kind of music?
So it's 1934. So we're in, like, kind of the, we're in the Depression era. We're also kind of flappery. But it is also a small town in the middle of nowhere. So it was
probably not, like, the highest fashion.
I would not think so. But it is the big band era. So maybe I'm assuming some like Duke Ellington, maybe some Johnny Hamp, maybe some like Midwestern swing.
Is there Midwestern
swing? There is like, or well, Western swing, I should say. Like Western, like country Western swing music, which is a genre of this era.
Nice. Yeah. So, so we have our I'm like, I always go into this, like, here we go, story time. And then we get to that point where we're starting to shoot out dates.
Right, right.
So let's just enjoy this dance hall moment.
Yes.
And then eventually we know it's going to take a turn.
It is going to take a turn. So okay. To set the stage a little bit more here, in case anyone is familiar, I'm not sure why, with Midwest today, the town of Midwest, it has a population right now of just a few hundred people. So it might be hard to picture what it was like in the 1930s, but Midwest itself started out as a company town. It was built by Midwest Oil Company during a rush to extract oil from the Salt Creek oil field.
Wait. So Midwest Oil was a thing before Midwest?
Yes.
Is this town named after a company?
Well, so it's a company town. So the company...
Is that a thing?
Yeah. So basically they would need workers, right?
Are there other towns named after companies?
Yes.
How am I only learning this now?
I don't know. So like, it's fascinating. So like companies would go to these areas and they would need essentially all these workers and they would create these company towns. They would build the housing. And the like really like awful thing that was happening, particularly at this era, was like you would be paid, you know, for your labor by the companies. And then you would also have to pay them for your rent on the housing. And they also ran the company stores in town.
Wait, so every cent you earned from the company got paid back to the company?
Pretty much.
I've heard of company towns before, and I thought it was just like a word for like a town that has a big company in it, not a town owned by a company.
Yeah, so they started Midwest, right? So I'm not sure the exact setup in this specific town about how things were done, but Midwest Oil Company starts the town of Midwest.
Huh.
Right, because they found oil, and so they're trying to get as many laborers as possible in this town. Now, the nearest population count I could come up with was from the 1920s, and the population here is like 10,000 or more, and that's in the 1920s. I'm not sure what it was in 1934. So it's really this central hub, which is serving oil field workers. And if they brought families, which they didn't always do, but if they did, them as well. Anyway, it's fall time, and the entertainment of the evening, as we remind ourselves, is dancing. And I am sure this place is hopping and packed with people, but there's three people that we need to keep track of in this dance hall. First, there's a 28-year-old man by the name of Carl Major. He's from the Northeast, specifically New Jersey, but he's been living out west for a while. He's been in Sheridan, Wyoming the year before, and I think specifically in Midwest Wyoming area for about a year. Most people take him as just this easygoing, good-natured kind of guy, and he's known as an oil man. And by that, I do not mean a wealthy oil well-owning kind of guy. No, he's employed by the Staniland Oil and Gas Company, which had taken over from Midwest Oil in 1932. So he's working for Staniland. Anyway, he's in the area doing ditch excavating and pipe laying.
Okay. So we've got our 28-year-old oil man, Carl.
Yes.
Okay.
Carl. Now, with him is his longtime girlfriend, Ella T. Cash. She's a petite brunette, just a few months older than Carl. And though she was born in Pennsylvania, she'd actually been living in Wyoming since childhood. Her family was living in Sheridan, so it seems like it's possible she came to Midwest with Carl. She's working locally as a maid, and I'm not sure of the exact location, but I do know huge rooming houses and hotels had sprung up to accommodate the men working in the field. So she's like, might be working in one of those establishments. Now, Carl and Ella had been dating for a while, like 6 years.
Okay, so at 28, that's a pretty long term.
Yeah, that's
commitment.
Significant. And as someone who was with their partner for 9 years before getting married, like me, like whatever.
Nine, right? For real?
Yeah.
Me too.
Oh, yay.
Okay. It's such an odd number.
Yeah. Like
nine.
We're just gonna just
like, we didn't want to like go at five, like commit at five or wait till 10.
Yeah.
Just nine.
Yeah, nine. Yeah. But, you know, so whatever. But it actually wasn't whatever to Ella. She wanted to get married to Carl, but he kept on putting her off, citing finances as an issue. And it's true that Carl had trouble holding onto jobs, but this was the Great Depression era. So, like, this wasn't unusual. On the other hand, he'd actually been with Stanilind for a while and yet didn't seem more inclined to marry her than he had before. So there's obviously some unresolved issues between the couple.
Okay.
And so the two of them are sitting at a table, listening to some music and watching other couples dance when Carl hears it, likely the most perfect melodic laugh he's ever heard.
No, he's there with his perfect laugh.
No.
We're not listening for other perfect laughs.
He was listening for another laugh.
No.
Yeah.
Carl. And
looking around, he locates the source. It's this gorgeous, tall redhead with bobbed hair, and she's sitting at a table alone.
No.
Are you feeling for Ella at this
moment? I am.
Okay. To compound this, he gets up. He leaves Ella by herself. Ella. Uh-huh. And he makes a beeline for this mystery woman. He discovers her name is Olga Schultz, and she's this 21-year-old who was born of two German-Russian parents, and she's been living between Midwest and the neighboring town in the Salt Creek field. The two of them talk for a while. And then Carl being clueless, thinks it's a good idea to bring this woman he's been immediately smitten with over to meet his long-term and much beleaguered girlfriend.
No, Carl!
Yeah.
For real?
For real.
So he hears this laugh. He looks over. He's like, woo, look at her. Yeah. I must speak to her now. Uh-huh. And now like, oh, wow, she's awesome. I'm going to introduce her to Ella.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, Carl.
So Ella, perhaps envisioning how this is about to go down and where this might lead, runs out of the dance hall, takes Carl's roadster, and like just peels out of the place. And she drives herself home in what is essentially a stolen car, but we're going to forgive her for that. Like,
she's forgiven.
I would have done that.
Imagine?
Yeah.
Imagine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it. That's never, nothing even remotely like that has ever happened to me.
Like, you? She's just had to watch her partner.
Of 6 years,
just leave her, like, get up, stand up, leave, and walk across the room to talk to this other woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the next few weeks, Carl won't leave Olga's side. The two go hiking together and rabbit hunting. I mean, I don't know if there's much to do in Midwest.
But so romantic.
Yeah. Like, but it is two activities they both enjoy. Olga's very outdoorsy, to be clear.
I'm not going to hold it against Olga.
No.
She likes to.
She's like, I like rabbit hunting.
Rabbit hunt. I'm sure a lot of other people do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're okay.
We're fine.
So Carl decides that this is the woman he needs to marry.
Really? So after 6 years of not marrying Ella, he's like immediately like, Olga's the one.
Not just Olga's the one, but I need to marry this woman and now.
Mm.
Yeah.
I just watched 500 Days of Summer last night. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever watched it.
I vaguely remember it.
It's so much like the kind of like she's in this relationship with this guy. And the whole time she's like, no, 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 no. And at the end, she shows up married.
Uh-huh.
And then he's like, I don't understand. You never wanted to be anyone's girlfriend, and now you're someone's wife. And she's just like, well, when you know, you know.
Yeah.
So maybe Carl just knows.
Carl says he knows. Like, and he goes and speaks to Ella finally after a few weeks. And she decides that, yes, so to speak, that she'll step out of the picture. This is like the terminology that was used in all the reports. Like, she'll step out of the picture. Now, within 3 days of this conversation, Carl and Olga elope.
Wow. So how long do we know how long it's been?
A few
total,
weeks.
Total, like since a meeting? Just weeks. Weeks?
Yeah.
We're not even months.
No.
Okay.
Now, the pair, accompanied by Olga's older sister, Emma, and Emma's husband, James, get into a car and they head to Nebraska for this elopement. This is so that Carl and Olga can get married by a judge in Harrison, Nebraska on Tuesday, September 11th, 1934. I honestly did not look this up, but my guess is that they go to Nebraska versus marrying in Wyoming for a difference of being able to marry more quickly in the other state. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, truly a whirlwind romance is happening here. Now, on the way back, they take kind of a scenic journey traveling through South Dakota and returning by way of Gillette, Wyoming. Carl was driving on an unfamiliar road in the dark, and they somehow got off course and almost drove into a graveyard before realizing their mistake. Apparently, of the incident, Carl said, "I hope this doesn't mean anything."
Does it?
Well, I mean, he's hoping it's not a bad omen, but you do know Olga goes missing.
Yeah, I do. So this is definitely not a great omen.
No. Now, back home in Midwest, the newlyweds start preparing for their honeymoon. The pair have decided the most romantic thing they can think of is to go to Togatee Pass in Teton County in northwestern Wyoming. This is where they're going to honeymoon. They're going elk hunting.
Oh. And that's the most romantic thing they could think of?
Mm-hmm.
Was elk hunting?
Elk hunting. Now, if people don't know, this is a really high mountain pass along the Continental Divide. It's up there at like 9,655 feet. So they're doing this wilderness adventure together.
But I also feel like if you are into the romance via rabbit hunting or elk hunting, we are not judging. We're simply laughing a little bit because we've never been romanced in this particular way.
I have not. No.
Yeah. But I mean, romance means different things to different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, just bring me books and, like, maybe like a...
Oh my God, books and trips.
A gentle hike.
A little walk in the woods with some snacks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe some like coffee and tea or tea.
Yeah. That's what we call hiking, but it's not what most of the people around here call a hike.
No, I think Olga would be like, okay. Now, the couple is packing up and they're gathering things from Olga's sister Edith, like a tent, a stove, and a Dutch oven. And Edith says it's around then that Olga and Carl receive a letter from Carl's now ex, Ella.
Oh, so she did not step entirely out of this story.
No, so now that they're married, she is devastated about this marriage. And she indicates in this letter that she might actually be thinking about committing suicide.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so she is, you know.
So this has really wrecked her.
Yeah, so this is like the man that she's been holding out with. I mean, honestly, it looks like she maybe did move to Midwest to be with him. And he, like, won't marry her, and then, oh, Olga, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's impossible to know exactly how Olga dealt with getting this letter or how she felt about it, but Edith says that on Saturday, so this is just days after her wedding, Olga didn't seem like an excited new bride packing for her honeymoon. According to Edith, Olga begged for Edith to go with her on this honeymoon, saying, "Please go with us, sis."
I wonder what changed.
Yeah. And so Edith declined, and she kind of made one joke at first, saying, "Oh, Ollie," by the way, that's what they called Olga, Ollie. "Oh, Ollie, three persons never go on a honeymoon." And then another kind of joke disguised as advice, and Edith tells her sister jokingly, Always carry two things that cost a nickel apiece: salt and matches. If you get lost, you might have to kill and eat a porcupine.
Is the salt just to put on the porcupine?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how you're prepared for a...
Just ready to...
You never know.
Cook and salt that porcupine.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a... Just like a...
Little advice. Yeah. Be prepared that you might end up... I don't know what that means. Like, might end up on your own? Might end up stranded?
Yeah, it's something like that. Huh. Now, with that, Olga and Carl set off. On Saturday night, the couple spent the night in Dubois, Wyoming, and on Sunday, they set off for their destination about 35-ish miles away. They made it to camp at the Frank Stalnaker Camp, which was located near the foot of Togatee Pass. They are near an area where Togatee Mountain Lodge is currently. Which, by the way, I discovered that this pass has tons of live cams, like webcams.
Wait.
Like,
so what are you seeing in them?
Right now, lots of snow.
Okay. But like, would you be watching people like hike, or would you be, what would you be seeing?
So one's animals? Like, one's like this downtown of Dubois, one's like up at the pass, like it's like near the lodge, and it's just like the parking lot. Like, I don't know. Okay. I got sucked in yesterday.
Okay. But all you saw was snow.
There's just a lot of snow right now. I mean, yeah, we are in winter, so. Now, they set up their camp near the regular hunting camp, but the next morning, September 17th, they decide they're not going to head out with the other hunters, preferring to scout out some locations on their own. Is this where you're getting nervous?
Well, yeah, because first off, they're engaging in kind of maybe risky things of not going with the group, and you just gave me a date.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you are a stick with the group kind of.
Yeah. Are you not?
No.
If you were out hunting in the middle of the wilderness, you would not stick with the group.
No. It's a lot of people.
Amy.
I don't want to be near the people.
Walk to the end of the pack.
And then you're stuck and everyone's going so slow.
Amy.
Okay. Well, they did this. They went on their own.
We'll be back in a moment.
The newlyweds headed to an area, and I really want to emphasize this, that had not been open to hunting previously. In fact, it rarely was in the years directly after. They didn't seem to bring very many supplies because they intended to head back to their camp at some point. But Olga did carry on her kind of a small hatchet, small axe in her belt. Olga was dressed appropriately for a day of hiking, wearing some pants and a sweater. She had on lace-up boots and a tam, which I'm taking to mean a specific type of cap and not a specific type of sweater like some man trying to tell me. Now.
Did some man try to tell you a tam was a sweater?
I was reading some articles and I was like, "That I don't think that's what we mean here." Now, They crossed the highway and the area they were walking through was pretty rough and they had to navigate around some fallen timber for about the first mile or so. As they closed in around mid-morning, Olga wanted to rest. Carl apparently did think this was unusual because Olga's pretty fit and they'd done kind of a lot of hiking together at this point. You know, as much hiking as you can do together in a few weeks of knowing each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. But Carl also wanted to keep going to the top of the pass where he would be able to see down to a heavily timbered valley where there were lakes and tiny streams. Carl felt this would be like truly a hunter's paradise, and he wanted to get a good look through his field glasses. He told Olga he would be back in about 20 minutes, and so he headed off following a well-defined game trail. You're giving me a look.
Wait, he just like walked away from her?
Yeah, he was like, I will be right back.
Where she's just like hanging out?
She's sitting on a boulder.
Sitting on a boulder in the woods, and so he chooses not to be with the group, which according to you, you would also. Mm-hmm. And now he's just like going to walk away.
Yeah, he's like, I'll be right back. Right. He says he looked back at Olga before she was out of view, and he said, you know, she's sitting on this boulder with a paper sack carrying the 3 or 4 sandwiches they'd packed balanced on her knees. Now, this part of where they are is not heavily timbered, but despite not being all that far from Olga, he couldn't actually see her from the direction he went because the view was blocked by a small knoll and a few scrubby pines. Carl maintained over and over that he had only been gone 20 to 30 minutes at most, but later he'd confessed that maybe he'd actually spent a bit longer than planned looking down at the fountain. But he said when he got back, she was gone.
Did he go back to the right spot? Did he get lost?
He did not get lost. So he followed this game trail up and he followed it back down.
Oh my God.
Now, nothing she had with her, not even the sandwich bag she was carrying, was left at the boulder where she had stopped to rest. He said he called her name, but heard no response, and he followed her trail of footsteps. But he said they ended abruptly in what he called the dusty little trail. Looking back and forth through the area for her, he repeatedly called her name. He looked around until eventually he headed back down to the camp on his own. He said by then it was too late to round up a search party to look for her because by then it was dark. I was curious, since we're dealing with old newspaper accounts here, and from my understanding, he last saw her around noon. That would have made sense since the sandwich was, if they were for lunch, they still hadn't eaten them yet, right? Mm-hmm. And sunset in this part of the mountains on that day would have been close to 7:30 p.m. So how long exactly is he saying he looked for her on his own?
Right.
Like 7 hours?
Right.
6 hours?
I don't know, but there's like, there could be animals or other people. Why is he wandering away from her? I just feel like if this happened now, this in this area, we would be reading about this on NCPR. And then they would be, so that's like the where they put the local ranger reports. And the rangers, like the it would be told from a reporting stance of not only like what happened, but how, like the numerous ways this could have been prevented.
Right. Because the rangers here are pretty sassy.
It's awesome. I love reading those because it's always like, this is what happened, but had we done this and this and this,
that wouldn't have been the case.
Right. Yeah. And I feel like I'm feeling this heavily right now.
Do you need to write a ranger report?
I would love to.
Okay. Now, the next day, a search party begins looking for Olga. Now, back home in Midwest, Olga's family doesn't find out that she's missing until they get the Tuesday evening paper. And they see a brief story about her disappearance in the papers.
Her poor family. That's awful.
Yeah. Now, Edith said that later, a long-distance call had come in for the family on Monday night, but an Edgerton resident had intercepted the call. Like, I believe this is at a time when, like, there would be a specific ring pattern for your house, so lots of people would just kind of listen in to each other's phone calls. So it seems in this case, though, someone else at another resident actually answered the phone and failed to pass on to the family that someone was trying to reach them. As soon as Olga's family found out, her two brothers, Fred and Walter, along with two brothers-in-law, jumped in their cars and headed to the mountains to search for Olga. Edith said that they were driving as fast as they could with their gas pedals floorboarded.
What?
Nothing. Okay.
Just like one dangerous behavior leading to another.
Got it.
Also, is floorboarded a thing?
That's the word she used.
Okay.
Okay. By the time the family members arrived, the search was well underway. There were locals from DuBois and Jackson Hole, as well as forest rangers. There was also dozens of civilian Conservation Corps members, but Edith would later say that their contributions were overstated since they were mostly boys from Nebraska who had never seen mountains before, let alone searched in them. They even brought in bloodhounds from the Colorado State Penitentiary.
But this is also days later, right?
Well, so it takes a while for the brothers to reach there, but like when they do, the search is underway. So the search starts for her the next morning.
And it's still underway
when they get there. So like the search starts, I think, Wednesday morning, and they don't get there until Friday.
Okay.
Now, Carl is, of course, he's out there searching as well, and reports are that he was running on very little to no sleep in this search. Now, the first successful signs that they found were a series of footprints, and these were 8 miles away from where Olga was last seen. Now, reading the papers, I'm not sure if these were the same or different footprints, but I do know there were reports that footsteps were found in a wooded section of Turpin Meadows on the west slope of the Continental Divide. This seemed hopeful, but after searching without much luck, a group of trackers from the Shoshone tribe were brought in, and they determined that no, these footprints are not from Olga. On Wednesday night, there were reports that a woman's voice could be heard shouting from a canyon near the top of the pass, but no one could definitively say if it was Olga. I mean, I don't know who else it would
be. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. But a search of that area the next morning yielded no clues. So was this just wind? Was it something people thought they heard?
Right.
Not sure there.
Okay.
Now, if Olga was out there, there were already concerns that she would have difficulty surviving. The terrain was tough, certainly, but most people described Olga as an avid outdoors woman. That doesn't mean accidents can't happen, but she didn't go prepared to spend nights out on the mountain. Like, even though it was only September, the nights were already cold and foggy. By Saturday, they weren't any closer to finding her when a snowstorm came in. There was driving snow and heavy sleet, and this lasted for days. Though they'd done some airplane flyovers at the area, as well as foot searches, both the planes and those on foot had to wait for better conditions to continue the search. Some people even had to be rescued from the area because of the adverse weather conditions.
Sounds like anything horrible that could go wrong is going wrong.
Right. Now, meanwhile, Wilford Nielsen, the county attorney, began to have his suspicions that Olga could have fallen victim to her new husband.
Are we thinking that?
This is like one of those, like, I have no idea.
You don't, okay, so you don't even have, like, because normally it's like, yeah, the husband did it. But in this case.
I have no idea.
Did he?
Oh. So he placed Carl on technical arrest, which basically meant that he wasn't in jail, but he wasn't free to leave Teton County without permission. A few days later, Olga's brother brought Carl to Jackson Hole for questioning. He was questioned repeatedly by Nielsen, who believed the couple must have argued on the mountain before Olga disappeared. Carl maintained that this was absolutely not true, that the two had never argued.
It hasn't been a long relationship, so I kind of believe it.
Right. I mean, you know, they're still kind of in this.
The happy bubble.
The happy bubble. The honeymoon period.
The honeymoon period. Because they're still in their honeymoon. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, even though he wasn't getting anywhere from Carl, he did place him in jail for nearly 2 months.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is what we want in all the ones where the husband actually did it.
You're like, could you
And it never something? Happens.
Yeah.
Usually it's just like, oh, yeah, what? He didn't do it. And then this time, this guy that is probably innocent,
maybe,
is getting put in jail for, okay.
Okay. Now, back on the mountain, the snowy weather did mean that they couldn't actually continue a search for Olga. At the time, the pass was hard to get through and the highway wasn't always open. In fact, it wouldn't be until the next year that there would be a push to keep the highway open through hunting season. Now, when Carl got out, we know that he headed home to New Jersey, where it's likely he spent the remainder of the winter. Meanwhile, Olga's family was hoping the search would be, like, relaunched in the spring, but the response then seemed much more tepid. It's now been months and a full winter since Olga went missing. Mm. Now, intermittently throughout 1935, searches were done of the area, and Olga's sister, Edith, offered a $100 reward, hoping that it would spur some response. Now, even though it was clear that the Schultz family all loved Olga, Edith does become kind of the family spokesperson in the search for her sister. It's through her that we get some indication about what types of theories were being explored and Edith's take on why none of them, like, quite fit. Now, a lot of the questions about Olga's disappearance center around why there are no clues, right? We know Carl said he followed her footsteps only a short distance before they disappeared. Edith said that by the time her family arrived on September 20th, the area had already been overrun by the Civilian Conservation Corps volunteer searchers, meaning that if there had been tracks, they would have been lost with so many people on the scene, particularly inexperienced trackers. Edith also said that there was a clear game trail that Carl had followed, so it wouldn't make sense for Olga to take a different route if she had decided to follow Carl after resting. There weren't, according to Edith, though, I'm guessing she received this information through Carl, there wasn't any indication Olga's footsteps, like, headed in that direction.
Okay.
Then there's a question of, did Olga just get tired of waiting for Carl, Mr. I'll be back in 20 minutes?
She could have gotten annoyed at that point.
And just been like,
I'm done.
Did she decide to go, like, head back down to camp herself? Or even did she decide to head off in a different direction for whatever reason? But Edith said it was particularly dry that year, meaning the earth was harder. And there were a lot of needles and leaves on the ground, making it possible that her footsteps just wouldn't have been visible in the first place. Of course, one of the main theories is, did Carl do something to harm Olga? The two had only known each other for this short amount of time, and there doesn't seem like anyone in the Schultz family like really knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the theory that the county attorney seemed to settle on, but there aren't any clues or details that support this theory beyond like speculation, right? His gun was even confiscated and checked to see if it had recently been discharged, and there was no indication that it had been.
It's hard to think that he would do it because they'd been together for just such a short amount of time. But at the same time, didn't you say it was his choice to not go with the group?
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, let's just stay back by ourselves.
Right.
And then his story about walking off. So who knows, right?
Now, there's this other question of whether or not Olga just simply ran away. Now, Ida says that Olga had on her about $30, which to put into perspective is almost close to $700 today.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. That like amount of purchasing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why is she carrying like $700?
Because like that's less than 100 years ago. And yes, what is she doing with that?
Yeah, I don't know. Now, also, Edith says that Olga was trained in stenography, so this is a very popular and much-needed career at the time. So, with this amount of money and these skills, was it possible that Olga simply hiked out of the mountains, back down to the highway she crossed, and, like, just hitched a ride to a new life? And why might that be the case? If we go back to her demeanor when she was packing up for the trip, like, she didn't seem excited about the honeymoon, and she didn't want to spend time alone with her new husband. So in addition, she just gotten that letter from Ella where Ella indicated how upset she was about Carl and Olga's marriage. Like, could it be possible that Olga also just felt bad about coming between the couple?
It could be. I mean, she's only 21.
Mm-hmm.
This is really overwhelming to meet a guy and then immediately marry him and then have this kind of like drama going on with his past.
Yeah.
That's a lot for a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean.
Yeah, and then suddenly to be like, oh, like, because she had been living with her family, to be clear. And I could not find the, you know, census records that indicated that she had a job because, like, the census records don't fall in the right time, right? But we do know that she'd been living with her family. So you're living with your family, and then suddenly, like, you go from that to, like, living with this man that you just met, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea that Olga simply ran away was clearly something Edith hoped was the case for the rest of her life. Like many of the cases we cover, there were plenty of sightings of Olga after her disappearance, particularly after news coverage of her case came up. Edith said she followed up on all these sightings, either in person or just like following up with them by mail or phone. She said some people saw Olga in Montana, Washington, California, and South Dakota, but none of those panned out. Edith said that she checked her mailbox every day, hoping to receive a letter from Olga, but nothing ever came. Then there's the question of if Olga could have died through suicide. Now, this is a possibility that Edith seems a bit more uncomfortable answering. One of the rangers had written down that Olga had written about wanting to in a letter. So we have this record from him.
Okay.
But could this just have been a misunderstanding of the story about that he'd been told about Ella, Carl's ex? Right? Like he just mixed up the story in his documents.
It could be. And would they not have found her had that happened? Like,
right.
And we really don't think an animal could have just...
No, so there's, like, no signs of, like...
No signs of that?
Yeah, there's okay. Nothing dropped, nothing scuffling.
Or, like, a different person in the woods?
Yeah. Now, like, all of these things are kind of possibility, but, like, Edith does reveal that Olga had some belongings, and one was a book, and on the flyleaf she'd handwritten a bit of the poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and the passage read... Like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread of having once turned round, walks on and turns no more his head because he knows a frightful fiend does close behind him tread.
Hmm.
So the question there was like, does this indicate some sort of mood that Olga's in? I mean, or it could just be she liked the quote. I don't know.
Right.
What's that an indication of, right?
Right.
I mean, it certainly sounds ominous, but we don't have any other
documentation. We have no context to it, yeah.
So while the years passed, Edith and her family returned over and over to the area that Olga was last seen to look for her. Meanwhile, Carl moved on to California. We know that in 1935, he was living in Sheridan, Wyoming, and it seemed like around 1938, he'd moved on to Redding, California. And this is a bit of fascinating information that I did some sleuthing to discover, and I'm going to share it because it's some 1930s/1940s gossip. So, and it's like tangential to Olga's story, but I'm still sharing it.
Okay. Now,
I'd read in a very recent article about Olga's disappearance that Carl waited until Olga was declared legally dead in 1941 and then soon after married Ella.
No.
The ex-girlfriend.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
For real?
Yeah. So, like, so intriguing, right?
So as soon as she was, like, legally dead and Ella did it?
Wow.
She wasn't, like, mad?
Well, so... I was like, I want to know more about this situation.
Yes.
But I'd also read a piece that Edith wrote in 1941. So Edith often wrote like articles for the paper and sometimes about her sister. And so in this 1941 article, she said that in the spring of that year, in year 7 of Olga being missing, Carl and the courts, out of deference to Edith and her sister Emma, declined to have Olga declared legally dead that spring, and instead, Carl quietly asked for a divorce so that he might marry Ella. And it's true that it was quiet. In May of 1941, there was only one brief note I could find about Carl and Olga, and that's because her case was of interest, right? Other than that, though, basically, because Olga was missing, Carl had to make a legal attempt to find her for the divorce. So buried in the legal section, he's asking Olga to come forward because this divorce case is pending. And this runs weekly throughout the month of May of 1941. And then the divorce is just granted on June 6th, 1941 on the grounds of desertion. So that seems kind of sweet, right? That Edith felt like some protections were being offered to the family, that, you know, he decided to go, like, keep things quiet for Olga's sake mm-hmm. and the family's sake. But I know something that Edith didn't know, thanks to the magic of online records with Ancestry.com. Like, I literally renewed my subscription this week so I could dig around these records.
So what do you know?
Okay, so the deal is that Carl likely had this whole other reason for wanting to keep this divorce as quiet as possible. And that's because he and Ella had been living as husband and wife while he was still married to Olga.
Oh, okay.
So in fact, Ella is listed as his wife on his World War II draft card in 1940.
Okay.
And they're mentioned in the newspapers as husband and wife because they were hosting some parties there in Redding.
So they just couldn't get legally married until everything, but they were already.
So yeah, they just like moved to California and just told people they were married. Like, okay. So we know that this was going on for a minimum of 1 year before that they'd been saying they were married, but likely this was happening a lot longer. I'm guessing at least 1938 when he decided to move to Redding. I don't even know if before then when he was living in Sheridan in 1935, but he went right back to Ella.
Scandal.
Yep. And again, this doesn't have something directly to do with Olga's disappearance, but honestly, this was like a moment where I was like, oh.
Well, just I think it actually, it says more about maybe the possibilities of Carl's character more than anything about Olga or what happened to, you know what I mean?
And, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We know like Olga, like according to her sister, was seeming to have some regrets, but was like Carl also seeming to have some regrets, right? Now, Carl and Ella never had any children, though they did breed Chesapeake Bay Retrievers. And Carl continued to hunt primarily in the West and Alaska. Thank you, newspaper records. Okay. I, though, have yet to find a record of their actual marriage.
Okay.
But it's clear that Carl and Ella did consider themselves as married. And other people, including Edith, believed this as well, that they were married. Now, Edith said this. As Olga had wished, Carl has finally married Ella. Olga would be the first to wish them happiness. Out of deference to me, the court did not decree Olga legally dead when Carl obtained his divorce. And while I agree with relatives that dead man can't write, I continue to haunt the mailbox, expecting to hear from her someday. So when friends ask why, I feel no resentment because Olga doesn't write. If I am sincere in thinking she's alive, my answer is this. I am afraid I should have done the same thing under the circumstances.
Wow, so she really thinks her sister just kind of was like, nope, Carl, you were into this with Ella. I'm out.
Yeah.
And just like moved aside and let them be together.
Yeah. So that's what Edith thought then.
Which is a nice thought because it's easier than the alternatives, right?
Right. I mean, it creates a scenario in which Olga, you know, went on to live.
She made life. A choice. She made and a choice. And she went on to live. Yeah.
Now, Edith called the search for her sister the search without ending. On the 25th anniversary of Olga's disappearance, Edith was asked what she thought then of her sister's disappearance. She said, I've reconciled myself to the belief that neither I nor my brothers, Walter and Fred, and my sister Emma will ever know what happened to our dear Ollie.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, In the Yellowstone, read by Susan Rattan. Known for her role of Roxanne on the acclaimed L.A. Law, for which she was nominated for Emmys on four consecutive seasons, she has seamlessly moved between television, stage, and film throughout her career. She has made many memorable television appearances on shows like Bosom Buddies, Newhart, Grey's Anatomy, Mom, and most recently, a recurring role on the Netflix hit series A Man on the Inside, starring Ted Danson. Susan has appeared in the feature films The Sure Hand of God, Love Kills, Honky Tonk Freeway, Independence Day, and Funny About Love. She has also had several television movie roles, including Helter Skelter, Terror in the Towers, and The Ultimate Christmas Present.
In the Yellowstone, Olga Schultz Major, 21, missing since September 17, 1934, from Dubois, Wyoming. After Harriet Monroe. Pearl pinhole light, glistening and ghosting. Pearl shimmering light that rustles and swoons. Tonguing light that glides across the seam of the mountains. Morning light that catches in the throat, unfurls its body in your body. Tenderling light that speaks in riddles, sets your body to gasping like it's drowning. Crushing light, sacred as a mouthful of honeysuckle cresting the snow-capped peaks. Oh, threadbare sun, seeping across the earth's dome, taking one day into the next, into the next. How do we make it out here? What calls do you hear through the thistles and scrub pine of these mountains? What language does this sorrow speak?
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.